This is FSRN, the weekly edition. I'm Nell Abram. Coming up on today's show, Balkan borders all but close as Turkey puts forth a controversial plan to address the migrant crisis. Human rights advocates are swift to condemn the proposal. State legislatures around the country have a raft of anti-LGBT bills on their dockets. Some say it's a bid to boost the religious right vote. We'll look at Oklahoma. And a new U.S. trade law could reverse 50 years of economic policy regarding the occupied Palestinian territories. Those stories and more on FSRN's Weekly Edition. The massive refugee crisis playing out across Europe took another dramatic turn this week, with various countries along the so-called Balkan migration route effectively sealing their borders to asylum seekers. The clampdown came after EU negotiators tentatively agreed to a plan that would return all migrants crossing the Aegean Sea back to Turkey in exchange for both economic and political concessions. Human rights advocates slammed the deal, saying it violates international law, but the plan seems to be advancing and the EU is set to finalize details next week. FSRN's Jacob Resnick explains.
European leaders are welcoming Turkey's offer to take back all refugees who cross into the European Union from its soil. And they agree, in principle, to both Turkey's demands for more than $3 billion in cash assistance toward caring for the 2 million-plus Syrian refugees it's hosting, and to ending the EU's visa requirement for Turkish citizens. Details are expected to be hammered out next week in Brussels. But Vincent Cochetel, head of the UN Refugee Agency's European Division, says he doesn't see a path forward for this plan without the EU running roughshod over the law.
Collective expulsion of foreigners is prohibited under the European Convention of Human Rights, so an agreement that would be tantamount to a blanket return of any foreigners to a third country is not consistent with European law, is not consistent with international law.
The broad agreement taking shape is a so-called one-in, one-out arrangement. Simply put, all refugees arriving in EU member Greece from Turkey would be returned, irrespective of nationality. But here's where it gets less clear. For each Syrian sent back to Turkey, another already in the country would be resettled inside the EU. The plan doesn't address those migrants from other countries like Afghanistan, Iraq, and elsewhere, most of whom are also fleeing war and violence. The proposal quickly set off alarm bells among human rights groups that say rounding up refugees collectively and doing business with Turkey, whose own human rights record is under question, is a bad idea. Amnesty International called it an alarmingly short-sighted and inhumane attitude to handling the crisis. The deal also has little chance of easing the growing crisis at the EU's external borders, where tens of thousands of refugees have been massing for weeks. And that's a source of frustration for the UN Refugee Agency, Cochetel told reporters in Geneva.
I have to say I'm a bit tired to hear about irregular migrants or illegal migrants when we know that 91% of the people arriving in Greece are Afghans, Iraqis, Syrians, fleeing for their life, fleeing because of the conflict, or fleeing because of the human rights violation in their country. They're not people that are looking for a better economic future. They're people that are fleeing those conflicts that are still unsolved today.
Meanwhile, European countries continue to seal their borders, leading to a backlog of refugees stuck in Greece. Slovenia announced Tuesday it would close its borders to refugees at midnight Wednesday. As the gates slammed shut, at least 30,000 people remain trapped in various parts of Greece, with aid agencies overwhelmed by what is becoming a humanitarian catastrophe. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Bonn, Germany.
Turkey's record on human rights is chief among concerns for those opposed to the pending migrant plan. Just days before proposing the still tentative deal, Ankara drew international condemnation for the government takeover of the country's leading newspaper, Zaman. Riot police used tear gas and water cannons to gain access and seize control of the paper's offices. Today's Zaman, the outlet's English-language website, hasn't published anything since the day after, and the paper's formerly independent editorial tone is now decidedly pro-government. And at an event to mark International Women's Day Tuesday, Turkey's president drew criticism when he remarked that a woman is above all else a mother. His comments came as no surprise to many women in the country. Since 2002, the Turkish government has promoted a policy prioritizing motherhood over individual rights for women. In 2015, lawmakers passed a fertility incentive bill, parts of which recently came into effect. But according to population data, the government's desire for a higher birth rate has yet to bear fruit. Fariba Nawa reports from Istanbul.
Like many other European countries, Turkey is faced with an aging population. Steady now at 80 million, the country's population is expected to decline in the next few decades. The fertility rate of 2.1 is forecast to drop to 1.8 by 2050, according to United Nations statistics. That's one reason the country's ruling Justice and Development Party, known as AKP, likes children. At least 3 to 5 per woman. This push isn't new. In the 14 years since their ascent to power, the AKP has introduced laws and pushed values extolling the virtues of motherhood and family.
I just recommend that you have 3 babies. This is my natural right as a prime minister. I'm not putting a gun to your head. There is no legal obligation. I'm just telling my sisters, who have the will to do this, to grant at least 3 children to this cause and for this country. This country must get strong. How do we do it? Through the honorable creation called human.
That was Turkey's then prime minister, now President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, in a seminal 2013 speech responding to critics who said the government has no right to impose on women's bodies. Some provisions of the AKP's fertility incentives took effect in 2015, like one-time cash handouts that increase with each child up to $200 per family. And in January of this year, the labor incentives kicked in, giving women with newborns working outside the house pay for part-time work for 6 months. If they decide to return to work, companies must give new mothers their jobs back. And if men choose to take care of the child and the mother continues to work full-time, the family still receives the same benefits. Shehnaz Kimyaz Bachesi of Women for Women's Human Rights in Istanbul says equality advocates oppose the incentive program, saying it's one of many AKP campaigns to take away women's rights in the name of family and country.
What happens is it still puts the weight of care services upon the women. It's just making women to work basically 1.5 jobs. And you still work at home taking care of your family and your children. And if you have elderly or disabled people in the household, you look after them as well. And at the same time, you'll be expected to work part-time or from home to contribute to the household income, while no one will be taking that care responsibilities off of your shoulders at all.
But some AKP supporters, including women, say it's a solution to their declining youth population. They agree that Turkey needs more young people to take care of its old. Nuran Durdau cleans houses and her husband is a construction worker. They have a daughter and son. Yet even with the new incentives in place, Nuran holds back from having the 3rd child, though she'd rather quit cleaning and have another baby.
I thank the government for implementing this social security for housewives, and I'm waiting for it.
But when she finds out what the incentives actually include, she realizes it's not enough to quit her job. Despite all the government's efforts, statistics show that many Turkish citizens, like Nuran, aren't taking the bait. Instead, the birth rate has slowly declined, primarily due to the rising cost of living, especially for education and childcare. Many parents say the quality of public education has deteriorated in the last decade, and a private education can cost from $500 to $1,000 a month. Yet the average monthly income is only $560. At a posh mall on the city's Asian side, parents chase after their children in a bookstore. Deniz Cengiz Türkmen, a lawyer, and her husband, Levent Türkmen, an engineer, are parents to 6-year-old Kuzay and 3-year-old Karen. Deniz is trying to convince her husband to have another child, but they're both uncertain about Turkey's future.
You know, the future of Turkey is not really shiny. And, you know, people are killing others for some reasons we never understand.
The government may have failed at convincing Turks to procreate more, but with more than 4 million Syrians, Afghans, and Kurdish refugees already in the country, Turkey's future population is bound to grow. And many people here say if the government would focus on improving security, public education, and lowering the cost of living, there would be no need to push for babies. Families would grow out of their own accord. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Fariba Nawa.
You're listening to FSRN, Free Speech Radio News, independent, non-commercial media. To find out how you can support FSRN, visit our website, fsrn.org. Democrats in the Missouri Senate launched a nearly 40-hour filibuster this week, but ultimately failed to stop what they call an anti-gay bill from advancing. Senate Joint Resolution 39 would create a constitutional amendment to override municipal non-discrimination laws and protect religious organizations from penalties for discriminating against gays and lesbians. Republicans advancing the bill say it would protect the religious liberty of Missourians. Large companies, including Dow Chemical, oppose the measure. The resolution would need to pass both houses and a ballot measure to become law. LGBT activists and allies say national groups are pushing anti-LGBT legislation, like the Missouri resolution and other bills, across the country to boost the religious right vote in an election year. No other state in the nation has more of these bills in play than Oklahoma. So far, the bills are facing resistance from businesses and even some conservatives. FSRN's Larry Buell has more from Oklahoma City.
So why are we actually in the room today? Because most Oklahoma legislators are fair-minded. There's about 5 who file a big volume of bad bills. Okay? So it's your usual.
Amanda McLean Snipes, organizational development and training manager with the Equality Federation of Oklahoma, coaches several dozen people at the state capitol on how to lobby lawmakers to kill several anti-LGBT bills currently before the legislature. When the Oklahoma legislature convened on February 1st, there was a record-setting 26 anti-LGBT bills on the docket. They included 3 transgender restroom exclusion bills, a bill that would make it illegal to ban controversial ex-gay therapy, and a bill preventing depressed youth from seeking a gay-affirming therapist. Last month, Oklahoma's Senate Judiciary Committee voted down the Oklahoma Right of Conscience Act. That would have allowed businesses to refuse to serve gay people as long as they showed it violated their sincerely held religious beliefs on gay or lesbian or transgender behaviors. Many gave the credit for its failure to the business community, led by AT&T, which lobbied hard against it. Troy Stevenson is executive director of LGBT rights group Freedom Oklahoma. He says the legislation is a reaction to marriage equality coming to Oklahoma in 2014.
Because of the progress in LGBTQ rights, this was an attempt to set that movement back. I think that many people in the legislature had been quiet for many years. They had passed pretty much everything they could have imagined at the time as far as anti-LGBT legislation. And then they got really imaginative the last couple of years with some of this really negative stuff.
Pro-gay activists point out that many of the so-called religious freedom bills are not coming from Oklahomans or Georgians or Missourians. They're often written and pushed by national groups like Alliance Defending Freedom. Religious freedom or religious exemption bills are written to let business owners defend their refusal to serve lesbian, gay, or bisexual or transgender customers on the basis of their religious faith, and the bills have similar wording state to state. Indiana passed a religious freedom bill last year, and immediately saw canceled conventions, speeches, and concerts because of it. Again, Troy Stevenson.
And in some of these conservative districts, there are representatives and senators that think this will help them, and it's been proving just the opposite, because not just Democrats, but many Republicans at the legislature have taken a stand on these issues and said that this is just not, this is hateful legislation. They won't hear it, and they realize that it will do a detriment to our state, as in what happened in Indiana and Arizona before that, and what's likely to happen in Georgia.
Residents here in Oklahoma City say attitudes toward LGBT and gender nonconforming people are changing, even in this solid red state.
But we're in the Bible Belt. I would get that question. Are you married, or, you know, are you a Christian?
Dr. Marlo Miller is an openly lesbian orthodontist in Oklahoma City. She says greater LGBT visibility has helped in convincing her fellow citizens to reject discrimination.
When I first opened my practice, I worried, how the community would feel, how referring doctors would feel, how my staff might even feel. But things have changed very significantly and certainly more positively in every light. And people see how you treat them. And if you treat them as they should be treated, then they're going to stand behind you no matter who you are or who you're married to.
That might be why, so far, the Oklahoma bills are failing. But some legislators see anti-LGBT bills as a surefire way to galvanize evangelical voters. Their detractors point out that it's not a coincidence that so many of these bills are being introduced in an election year. Last year, Oklahoma Democratic State Representative Emily Virgin attached a clever poison pill to a religious exemption bill, an amendment stating that businesses could discriminate based on religious beliefs only if they clearly post their policy on their website and at their place of business. Party affiliation isn't always a guarantee for determining how legislators will vote. Republican Representative Leslie Osborne from Oklahoma's 47th District says morality legislation veers into government overreach.
It's construed as an issue that's really Republican-Democrat. And my belief is that as a Republican, that we absolutely need to stay out of people's personal lives. We need to stay out of people's bedrooms. That's not our job. The Founding Fathers intended for us to take the proper amount of taxes and to administer core services well.
Still, the bills keep coming. According to the gay rights group Human Rights Campaign, more than 100 anti-LGBT measures have been filed across the U.S. in the first 2 months of this year. LGBT rights groups are not taking anything for granted. They're continuing to meet lawmakers one-on-one to, as they put it, remind them what's at stake for individuals and for their states. Larry Buell, FSRN, Oklahoma City.
British private security contractor G4S announced this week that the company will liquidate its operations in Israel after reporting a steep drop in annual profits. The multinational, which sells services and equipment to Israeli detention centers and West Bank checkpoints, has long been a focus of the BDS movement. But a new U.S. law, signed late last month by President Barack Obama, may complicate the economic shaming campaigns that have been gaining traction around the world. The stated aim of the Trade Facilitation and Trade Enforcement Act of 2015 is to remove unfair barriers to competitive U.S. trade, but the legislation also includes provisions designed to oppose boycotts and similar economic measures against Israel. While the bill passed without much controversy or coverage in the U.S., Lena Odgaard reports that its implications could mark a change in 50 years of U.S. policy on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
As you see, the line of chairs, we produce more than 2,000 pieces a day.
Yehuda Cohen is the CEO of Lipsky, an Israeli company that produces plastic products. The factory is located around 10 miles inside the Palestinian West Bank, but labels on the products state made in Israel.
Of course made in Israel, of course made in Israel. It's made in Israel.
Israeli settlements in the West Bank, including the industrial areas, are deemed illegal under international law. Still, they continue to grow and are today home to more than 500,000 Israelis. For decades, the U.S. has been a lead broker in Israeli-Palestinian peace negotiations. U.S. administrations have repeatedly condemned Israeli construction in the occupied Palestinian territories. But a new trade bill might set a new precedent for American policy. On February 24th, President Barack Obama signed a trade bill that doesn't distinguish between Israeli companies inside its internationally recognized borders and within the occupied West Bank.
So it's incredibly problematic.
Speaking to FSRN over the phone from the U.S., Sarah Sadoun from Human Rights Watch worries about the implications. I mean,
it's basically redefining Israel in a way that contravenes states' duties not to recognize Israeli sovereignty over the settlements.
Obama expressed the same concern when signing the bill, saying that by conflating Israel in the Israeli-controlled territories, certain provisions are contrary to long-standing U.S. policy. He stated that while he is president, he will not apply the part of the bill tied to the protection of West Bank settlements. But the statement doesn't prevent future presidents from applying it. And this would signal the end of the two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, says Palestinian-American businessman Sam Bahur.
Because if this legality of settlements is given, then the whole paradigm of two states no longer has a meaning.
In addition to the trade bill, Illinois and South Carolina passed similar anti-boycott laws last year. Another 11 states are considering similar measures.
It's completely removing the notion that there is another piece of land that is not part of the Israeli sovereign. So not only is it legalizing settlements, it's also giving Israel the ability to claim all of the land from the river to the sea.
The state-level bills are a response to a growing movement calling for boycott, divestment and sanctions, in short BDS, against companies profiting from the Israeli occupation. The legislation targets boycotts against Israel on both a national and international level. This severely restricts personal freedoms, says Sa'adun from Human Rights Watch.
I mean, the provisions are problematic from a broader perspective, because they, you know, seek to disrupt this nonviolent civil society movement.
The BDS movement in the U.S. has gained significant support in recent years. Artists, musicians, student unions, academics, and religious groups and congregations have publicly announced different forms of boycotts targeting Israeli goods and services. In January, the United Methodist Church, representing 13 million members, decided to divest from Israeli banks operating in the settlements. And bowing to enormous pressure from the BDS movement, the Israeli company SodaStream closed its last factory in the West Bank on February 29th. 60% of the West Bank is under full Israeli control and inaccessible for Palestinian development, leaving the economy dependent on donor aid. A recent report by Human Rights Watch concludes that settlement businesses contribute to Israel's violations of Palestinian rights. The Lipsky Plastics factory is located in the Israeli industrial park Barkan. Research by Human Rights Watch indicates that Barkan lies on privately owned Palestinian land confiscated by the Israeli army in 1981. Today it's one of 14 industrial zones with a total of around 1,000 Israeli businesses across the West Bank. By generating jobs and taxes for the settlement municipalities, they foster continuous growth, says Sa'adun.
By basically helping settlements to function, they are also contributing to Israel's unlawful confiscation of West Bank land and other resources, which under international law can only be used for the benefit of the Palestinian people or for strict military necessity.
As a countermove, pro-Israeli lobby groups seek to fight the boycotts. One way is by introducing politicians and opinion makers to factories like Lipsky.
I want to show them that boycott or destroyed industrial areas, this is not the way. I say to everybody, I'm not a settlement. I'm industrial area.
Cohen says that lately he has welcomed several American officials, as well as ambassadors and parliamentarians from around the world. Palestinian rights activists fear that this diplomatic battle will lead to more anti-boycott legislations in and outside of the U.S. Lina Otgor reporting for FSRN from Barkan and Ramallah in the West Bank.
In India, the soft drink giant Coca-Cola has decided to suspend bottling operations at three units located in three different states of the country. One of these units, in the city of Kaladera in the western Indian state of Rajasthan, has been the target of a years-long community-led campaign that blames the company for exacerbating water shortages in the area. Coca-Cola says the plant closure is due to long-term economic non-viability. FSRN's Jasvinder Sagal reports from Kaladera.
When the Coca-Cola company announced plans last month to shut down its bottling plant here in Kaladera, many local residents took it has good news. Water shortages were already a reality here when the company set up shop in 2000. Area farmers say Coca-Cola's operations made the situation worse, and some farmers organized a campaign demanding closure of the plant. 72-year-old agronomist Rameshwar Kodi helped lead the campaign.
Coca-Cola was extracting groundwater through 50 horsepower motors, while the local farmers were allowed to use only 5 horsepower motors. Being a multinational company, they had electricity 24 hours a day, while the local farmers only had access to 5 hours of electricity. Today, even major farms lack groundwater.
In 2008, as a result of a student-led campaign at the University of Michigan, Coca-Cola agreed to pay for an assessment of its bottling plant in India. Kodi says that the Energy and Resources Institute, TERI, which conducted the study, recommended that Coca-Cola specifically shut down its plant in Caladera. The competition over scarce water resources has also forced some multi-generational farmers out of agriculture and into factory jobs. 62-year-old Cheetar Lal used to grow vegetables on his 3-acre farm, but now works in a local factory.
When I was very young, there was no scarcity of water. There was no water shortage, even in the dry summer months. But today, the water is almost gone. Groundwater levels have plummeted ever since Coca-Cola began operations. The mining of groundwater in a water-scarce area has aggravated the water shortages for us. Today, we don't have enough water to drink.
As the once dominant profession of farming waned in Caladera, the Coca-Cola plant became a source of steady employment for hundreds of area locals. Lalchan, who gave only his first name, worked in the bottling plant for 15 years. He lost his job in an early wave of layoffs before the plant transitioned to a storage facility for its inventory. He has now opened a shoe repair shop in front of the closed facility.
I started working here in 2001. The company closed its operation all of a sudden without giving any prior notice or information. We've been unemployed for almost 3 months now, so I opened this cobbler shop because I know how to repair shoes. But many of my colleagues don't know any other craft. They come here every day hoping that Coca-Cola will resume bottling and give us jobs again.
Coca-Cola attributes its decision to close the Caladera facility to economic issues. But allegations of water mismanagement dog Coca-Cola across India and have forced the closure of their bottling plant in Kerala in 2005 and Varanasi in August 2014. The government of the southern state of Tamil Nadu withdrew Coca-Cola's land allocation for a new bottling plant due to large-scale community protests in April last year. The company is also currently the subject of a court-ordered investigation as to whether its second largest plant in India has been illegally discharging untreated wastewater. Caladera-based water campaigner Mahesh Yogi says the closure of the local plant is a good start, but that Coca-Cola and its investors should be held responsible for the area's depleted watershed and financially devastated farmers.
This is only the start of our fight. This is not a win. We will struggle until Coca-Cola repays all the financial loss to the farmers in form of compensation. I cannot tell you about our future strategy as being a multinational giant. Coca-Cola can go to any extent to curb our demands. It took us 13 years to get this far. We don't want to struggle that much again in order to get compensation.
Rapidly dropping groundwater levels have made many residents of water-scarce regions decide that access to fresh water is more precious than the luxury of carbonated drinks. Jaswinder Sehgal, FSRN, Caladera, India.
And that does it for this week's program. From Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram. Thanks for listening.